finally a female baby. That means there was only a 12.5% chance that all three leaders would be born male, and an 87.5% chance that at least one would be born female. The ripple effects of different results are unknowable, but potentially enormous. If Anna Hitler had been born on April 20, 1889, and Braunau am Inn, Austria, World War II might never have happened. Or a smarter Nazi dictator might have visited even worse horrors upon us by making shrewder decisions. All three of us see history this way. Counterfactuals highlight how radically open the possibilities once were, and how easily our best-laid plans can be blown away by flapping butterfly wings. Immersion in what-if history can give us a visceral feeling for Taleb's vision of radical indeterminacy. Savoring how history could have generated an infinite array of alternative outcomes, and could now generate a similar array of alternative futures, is like contemplating the 100 billion known stars in our galaxy, and the 100 billion known galaxies. It instills profound humility. Kahneman, Taleb, and I agree on that much. But I also believe that humility should not obscure the fact that people can, with considerable effort, make accurate forecasts about at least some developments that really do matter. To be sure, in the big scheme of things, human foresight is puny. But it is nothing to sniff at when you live on that puny human scale. Chapter 12. What's next? For months, the outcome wasn't in doubt. Excluding undecideds, about 43% of Scots said they would vote yes in the September 18, 2004 referendum on Scotland leaving the United Kingdom. 57% favored no. But 2 weeks before the referendum, the polls shifted rapidly, giving yes the edge. The last few polls before the vote revealed another small shift, putting no in the lead by a nose, with as many as 9% of voters still undecided. Would the 307-year-old United Kingdom survive? The answer seems obvious now, as it usually does after the fact. It wasn't then. The Yes campaign had appealed to nationalist sentiment. The No campaign had countered that Scotland's economy would be crippled by separation. Some pundits argued that nationalist identity politics would trump economic calculations. Others expected the reverse. The one highly probable outcome was that whatever happened, pundits would immediately explain why. As it turned out, no one won by the surprisingly wide margin of 55.3% to 44.7%. Super forecasters aced this one, incidentally, even beating British betting markets with real money on the table. But one pundit broke ranks. I was all set to have some fun today writing a post that would have been a choose-your-own-analysis adventure in the wake of Scotland's referendum, wrote the political scientist and Washington Post blogger Daniel Dresner the day after Scotland voted no. It would have had sentences like, "Yesterday's referendum is a clear demonstration of the enduring power of nationalism in the 21st century," / "the resilience of economics in the minds of voters in the West." And maybe pundits who predicted a no/yes outcome were too quick to discount the bland appeal of economics/the goods that nationalism cannot deliver. I wish Dresner had continued in that vein. It would have been a delightful poke at the insta-analysis of too sure of themselves commentators. But Dresner did something else. He confessed that he had personally been unsure of the outcome, and was surprised by the wide margin of no's victory. "It was a teachable moment for punditry," Dresner wrote, "which is to say, what does one do with data points like this to adjust one's worldview? What a fabulous question. On the one hand, the hindsight-tainted analyses that dominate commentary after major events are a dead end. Many factors were at work in the Scottish referendum, so economics trumped nationalism leaves too much out. It's even more misguided to blithely conclude that because economics trumped nationalism here, it will do so elsewhere. On the other hand, our expectations of the future are derived from our mental models of how the world works, and every event is an opportunity to learn and improve those models. But as Dresner noted, effective learning from experience can't happen without clear feedback. and you can't have clear feedback unless your forecasts are unambiguous and scorable. Sound familiar? It should. Dresner cited an article about the IARPA tournament. "I'm certainly guilty of the vagary of prediction," he wrote. Prior to the Scottish referendum, he had thought no would win, but he wrote a post about why yes might win instead. So what had he forecast? It wasn't clear. How should he change his thinking in light of the outcome? That too wasn't clear. So, going forward, when I write about a discrete event like the Scottish referendum, I'll try to do two things: make a clear prediction, and offer a confidence interval about that prediction. In other words, I want to keep score. That was precisely the reaction I hoped for. With scores and leaderboards, forecasting tournaments may look like games, but the stakes are real and substantial. In business, good forecasting can be the difference between prosperity and bankruptcy. In government, the difference between policies that give communities a boost and those that inflict unintended consequences and waste tax dollars. In national security, the difference between peace and war. If the U.S. intelligence community had not told Congress it was certain that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, a disastrous invasion might have been averted. IARPA understands the enormous potential in keeping score. That is why it bankrolled this project. Tournaments help researchers learn what improves forecasting and help forecasters sharpen their skills with practice and feedback. Tournaments could help society, too, by providing tools for structuring our thinking about what is likely to happen if we venture down one policy path or another. Vague expectations about indefinite futures are not helpful. Fuzzy thinking can never be proven wrong. And only when we are proven wrong so clearly that we can no longer deny it to ourselves will we adjust our mental models of the world, producing a clearer picture of reality. Forecast, measure, revise. It is the surest path to seeing better. Dan Dresner saw that. In my daydreams, so will everyone who reads this book, and serious change will begin. Consumers of forecasting will stop being gulled by pundits with good stories and start asking pundits how their past predictions fared, and reject answers that consist of nothing but anecdotes and credentials. Just as we now expect a pill to have been tested in peer-reviewed experiments before we swallow it, we will expect forecasters to establish the accuracy of their forecasting with rigorous testing before we heed their advice. And forecasters themselves will realize, as Dan Dresner did, that these higher expectations will ultimately benefit them, because it is only with the clear feedback that comes from rigorous testing that they can improve their foresight. It could be huge, an evidence-based forecasting revolution, similar to the evidence-based medicine revolution, with consequences every bit as significant. Or nothing may change. Revolutionaries aren't supposed to say failure is possible, but let's think like super forecasters here and acknowledge that things may go either way. In this closing chapter, I size up the strongest force resisting change and why, despite it, the status quo may be in for a shock. Then I look at something I can control, my future research. Whether it will be conducted amid a tumultuous change, as I hope, or a stagnant status quo, as I fear, will be decided by the people whom political scientists call the attentive public. I'm modestly optimistic, but readers can make the final forecast. The Kato Kugo status quo. In the months prior to the 2012 presidential election, Nate Silver's forecasts consistently had Obama leading Mitt Romney. Even when polls showed Romney breathing down Obama's neck, and the phrases 50-50 and too close to call echoed through the media, Silver's forecast never had Obama below a 61% chance of winning. Republicans reviled Silver and accused him of bias. Democrats defended his integrity and praised his forecasting acumen, and showered him with extravagant praise when Obama won. But in March 2014, when Silver issued forecasts that suggested the Republicans would take control of the Senate in that November's midterm elections, many Democrats had a change of heart. Some officials even passed around old forecasts of Silver's that had failed. Same forecaster, same track record, but when his forecasts ceased to align with partisan purposes, he was demoted from prophet to stumblebum. It was an extreme illustration of a problem I swept under the rug in Chapter 1, when I said the exclusive goal of forecasting should be accuracy, and that would be the sole concern of this book. In reality, accuracy is often only one of many goals. Sometimes it is irrelevant. This unseemly truth is usually disguised, but occasionally the mask falls. As it did when an analyst with the Banco Santander Brasil S.A. warned wealthy clients that Brazil's stock market and currency would likely decline if a left-wing candidate continued her ascent in the polls. The candidate and her party were livid and demanded the analyst be fired. She was, immediately, because in Brazil it's not good for a bank to be on bad terms with potential future presidents. Whether the analyst's forecast was accurate did not matter in the slightest. Like many hardball operators before and since, Vladimir Lenin insisted politics, defined broadly, was nothing more than a struggle for power. Or as he memorably put it, kato kago. That literally means, who whom. And it was Lenin's shorthand for, who does what to whom. Arguments and evidence are lovely adornments, but what matters is the ceaseless contest to be the kato, not the kago. It follows that the goal of forecasting is not to see what's coming. It is to advance the interests of the forecaster and the forecaster's tribe. Accurate forecasts may help do that sometimes, and when they do, accuracy is welcome. But it is pushed aside if that's what the pursuit of power requires. Earlier, I discussed Jonathan Schell's 1982 warning that a Holocaust would certainly occur in the near future unless we rid ourselves of our nuclear arsenals, which was clearly not an accurate forecast. Schell wanted to rouse readers to join the swelling nuclear disarmament movement. He did. So his forecast was not accurate, but did it fail? Lenin would say it did exactly what it was supposed to do. Dick Morris, a Republican pollster and former advisor to President Bill Clinton, underscored the point days after the presidential election of 2012. Shortly before the vote, Morris had forecast a Romney landslide. Afterward, he was mocked. So he defended himself. The Romney campaign was falling apart. People were not optimistic. Nobody thought there was a chance of victory, and I felt that it was my duty at that point to go out and say what I said, Morris said. Of course, Morris may have lied about having lied, but the fact that Morris felt this defense was plausible says plenty about the kato-kago world he operates in. You don't have to be a Marxist-Leninist to concede that Lenin had a point. Self and tribe matter. If forecasting can be co-opted to advance their interests, it will be. From this perspective, there is no need to reform and improve forecasting, and it will not change, because it is already serving its primary purpose well. But before giving up, let's remember that Lenin was a tad dogmatic. People want power, yes, but they value other things too. And that can make all the difference. Change. A century ago, as physicians were slowly professionalizing and medicine was on the cusp of becoming scientific, a Boston doctor named Ernest Amory Codman had an idea similar in spirit to forecaster scorekeeping. He called it the end result system. Hospitals should record what ailments incoming patients had, how they were treated, and, most important, the end result of each case. These records should be compiled and statistics released so consumers could choose hospitals on the basis of good evidence. Hospitals would respond to consumer pressure by hiring and promoting doctors on the same basis. Medicine would improve, to the benefit of all. Codman's plan disregarded a physician's clinical reputation or social standing as well as bedside manner or technical skills, noted the historian Ira Rutkow. All that counted were the clinical consequences of a doctor's effort. Today, hospitals do much of what Codman demanded, and more, and physicians would find it flabbergasting if anyone suggested they stop. But the medical establishment saw it differently when Codman first proposed the idea. Hospitals hated it. They would have to pay for record keepers, and the physicians in charge saw nothing in it for them. They were already respected. Keeping score could only damage their reputation. Predictably, Codman got nowhere. So he pushed harder, and alienated his colleagues so badly he was booted from Massachusetts General Hospital. Codman opened his own little hospital, where he personally paid for statistics to be compiled and published, and he continued to publicize his ideas, using increasingly intemperate means. At a meeting of a local medical society in 1915, Codman unfurled an enormous cartoon that poked fun at various dignitaries, including the president of Harvard University. Codman was suspended from the medical society and lost his Harvard teaching post. The status quo seemed unassailable. But the hue and cry over Codman's cartoon created a nationwide buzz, Rutkow wrote. Medical efficiency and the end result system were suddenly the hot topic of the day. As the profession and the public learned of Codman's ideas, a growing number of hospitals across the country implemented his scheme. Codman became a sought-after speaker, and when the fledgling American College of Surgeons formed a commission on hospital standardization, he was appointed its first chairman. Much that Codman advocated was never adopted. He was an inexhaustible idealist. But ultimately, his core insight won. If Cato Cagot were the decisive force in human affairs that Lenin and others took it to be, evidence-based medicine, which was a threat to everyone who was anyone in the medical hierarchy, would have been stillborn. But Ernest Codman, Archie Cochran, and many others overcame entrenched interests. They did it not by storming the ramparts. They did it with reason and a relentless focus on the singular goal of making the sick well. Their success inspired others. Evidence-based policy is a movement modeled on evidence-based medicine, with the goal of subjecting government policies to rigorous analysis, so that legislators will actually know, not merely think they know, whether policies do what they are supposed to do. As a result, in the United States, the United Kingdom, and elsewhere, there is probably more top-quality policy analysis being done than ever before. Of course, politics will always be politics, and politicians will always factor in partisan advantage and ideological conviction, but there is plenty of evidence that rigorous analysis has made a difference in government policy. The same thinking is transforming charitable foundations, which are increasingly making funding contingent on stringent program evaluation. Those that deliver are expanded, those that fail are shuttered. In line with Bill Gates's insistence on having clear goals and measures, the Gates Foundation, one of the world's largest, is renowned for the rigor of its evaluations. Sports provide striking examples of the growth and power of evidence-based thinking. As James Surowiecki noted in The New Yorker, both athletes and teams have improved dramatically over the last 30 or 40 years. In part, that's because the stakes are bigger. But it also happened because what they are doing has increasingly become evidence-based. When John Madden coached the Oakland Raiders, he would force players to practice at midday in August in full pads, Surowiecki noted. Don Shula, when he was head coach of the Baltimore Colts, insisted that his players practice without access to water. Thanks to scientific research in human performance, such gut-informed techniques are going the way of bloodletting in medicine. Training is far more rational and data-driven, Surowiecki wrote. So is team development, thanks to rapid advances in Moneyball-style analytics. A key part of the performance revolution in sports, then, is the story of how organizations, in a systematic way, set about making employees more effective and productive. All these changes have been catalyzed by rapid advances in information technology. We can count and test like never before. And we are. Seen in this broader perspective, an evidence-based forecasting movement would not be a startling change springing up out of nothing. It would be another manifestation of a broad and deep shift away from decision-making based on experience, intuition, and authority. Do this because I think it will work, and I'm an expert. Toward quantification and analysis. Far from being surprising, one might even think, what took so long? Perhaps the best reason to hope for change is the IARPA tournament itself. If someone had asked me a decade ago to list the organizations that most needed to get serious about forecasting, but were least likely to do so, the intelligence community would have been at the top. Why? Kato Kago. Evidence-based forecasting will improve their work in the long run, but it's dangerous in the short run. Recall the wrong side of maybe fallacy that leads people to conclude a forecast of there is a 70% chance an event will happen is wrong if the event doesn't happen. It was a big reason why Sherman Kent's modest proposal to attach numerical ranges to forecasts went nowhere. Use the number and you risk being unfairly blamed. Stick with phrases as fuzzy as a puff of smoke and you are safe. This thinking is tempting in many organizations, but it's irresistible in the intelligence community, which has so often been whipsawed between condemnations. After 9/11, the IC was blamed for failing to connect the dots and underestimating the risk of terrorist attacks. After the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the IC was blamed for connecting unconnected dots and overestimating the risk of weapons of mass destruction. Each time this happens, the IC responds by going to extremes to avoid making the sort of mistake it just made. If it failed to raise an alarm when a threat was real, it raises alarms at the slightest sign of trouble. If it raised a false alarm, it becomes wary of crying wolf. This blame game ping pong does nothing to make the intelligence community improve. It even prevents the long-term investments necessary to get better at forecasting. What would help is a sweeping commitment to evaluation. Keep score. Analyze results. Learn what works and what doesn't. But that requires numbers, and numbers would leave the intelligence community vulnerable to the wrong side of maybe fallacy, lacking any cover the next time they blow a big call. Imagine a director of national intelligence in a congressional hearing to explain why intelligence analysts didn't see some huge event coming, a revolution or a terrorist strike, before it was too late. "Well, we're generally pretty good at these things and getting better," he says, taking out a chart. "See, our evaluations show the Brier scores of our analysts are solid, and there has been significant improvement over time. We have even caught up with those annoying super forecasters. So while it's true we missed this important event, and terrible consequences followed, it's important to keep these statistics in mind. And yet, despite all this, the intelligence community did fund the IARPA tournament. I've also seen strong interest from the Director of National Intelligence in making scorekeeping an integral part of intelligence analysis. Of course, it could all be undone in a heartbeat. But still, that's an amazing and welcome change. History may be on our side, in the long run. The Humanist's Objection. Balancing it all out, count me as cautiously optimistic that my work may contribute to an evidence-based forecasting movement. But this is not a prospect everyone embraces. I need only imagine how my life might have gone differently to know how the objection might be framed. In 1976, I was a clueless 22-year-old Canadian who, like countless others, was about to make choices that would shape the rest of my life. I had just graduated from the University of British Columbia. I thought I might accept a Commonwealth scholarship to study the humanities at Oxford. My advisor, Peter Sudfeld, thought that was a terrible idea. "Go to the United States and commit to the scientific method," he said. I took his advice, but only hesitantly. My decision could have gone the other way. And if I had left for Oxford and a career in the humanities, I can easily guess what I would have said about the research outlined in this book and the next steps it will take. "Numbers are fine and useful things," I would say in that alternate universe, "but we must be careful not to be smitten with them. Not everything that counts can be counted," goes a famous saying, "and not everything that can be counted counts." In this era of computers and algorithms, some social scientists have forgotten that. As the cultural critic Leon Wieseltier put it in the New York Times, "There are metrics for phenomena that cannot be metrically measured. Numerical values are assigned to things that cannot be captured by numbers." This naive positivism is running rampant, taking over domains it has no business being in. As Wieseltier poetically put it, "Where wisdom once was, quantification will now be." I actually feel that there is a lot of truth in this perspective. Far too many people treat numbers like sacred totems offering divine insight, The truly numerate know that numbers are tools, nothing more, and their quality can range from wretched to superb. A crude version of Codman's end-result system that simply tracked patient survival might result in a hospital boasting that 100% of its patients live, without mentioning that the hospital achieves this bragging right by turning away the sickest patients. Numbers must be constantly scrutinized and improved, which can be an unnerving process because it is unending. Progressive improvement is attainable. Perfection is not. This is how I see Breyer scoring a forecast accuracy. It is a work in progress. One problem is that Breyer scores treat false alarms the same as misses. But when it comes to things like terrorist attacks, people are far more concerned about misses than false alarms. Fortunately, adjusting the scoring to capture this concern is easy. Forecasters just have to be told in advance what the ground rules are. False positives will cost you 1/10 as much as false negatives, so they can adjust their judgments accordingly. But don't suppose that because a scoring system needs tweaking, it isn't a big improvement. Consider consumer credit ratings, whose flaws are so often criticized. Decades ago, before credit scores, loan officers could make decisions almost whimsically, and your fate could hinge on whether you reminded them of someone, or they had slept poorly the night before, or they harbored stereotypes of shiftless blacks and flighty women. Credit scores may be miles from perfect, but they're a huge advance from that. Similarly, while I can't claim my scoring system is perfect, it is a big improvement on judging a forecaster by the criteria used nowadays. Titles, confidence, skill at spinning a story, number of books sold, CNN appearances, and time spent at Davos. But even the most skeptical humanities professor would concede these points, I suspect. The challenge runs deeper, and it brings us back to that line about the countable not always being worth counting. The question that counts. In the spring of 2013, I met with Paul Saffo, a Silicon Valley futurist and scenario consultant. Another unnerving crisis was brewing on the Korean Peninsula, so when I sketched the forecasting tournament for Saffo, I mentioned a question IARPA had asked. Will North Korea attempt to launch a multi-stage rocket between 7 January 2013 and 1 September 2013? Saffo thought it was trivial. A few colonels in the Pentagon might be interested, he said. But it's not the question most people would ask. The more fundamental question is, how does this all turn out? He said. That's a much more challenging question. He then offered a long answer that glided smoothly from country to country and leader to leader, a bravura performance of the sort that anyone who attends think tank conferences or watches pundit panels on TV would recognize. But was Saffo right? Even today, I don't know. What he said was just too vague to judge. That's typical of the answers to big, important questions like, how does this all turn out? So we confront a dilemma. What matters is the big question, but the big question can't be scored. The little question doesn't matter, but it can be scored, so the IARPA tournament went with it. You could say we were so hell-bent on looking scientific that we counted what doesn't count. That is unfair. The questions in the tournament had been screened by experts to be both difficult and relevant to active problems on the desks of intelligence analysts. But it is fair to say these questions are more narrowly focused than the big questions we would all love to answer, like, how does this all turn out? Do we really have to choose between posing big and important questions that can't be scored, or small and less important questions that can be? That's unsatisfying. But there is a way out of the box. Implicit within Paul Saffo's how does this all turn out question were the recent events that had worsened the conflict on the Korean Peninsula. North Korea launched a rocket in violation of a UN Security Council resolution. It conducted a new nuclear test. It renounced the 1953 armistice with South Korea. It launched a cyber attack on South Korea, severed the hotline between the two governments, and threatened a nuclear attack on the United States. Seen that way, it's obvious that the big question is composed of many small questions. One is, will North Korea test a rocket? If it does, it will escalate the conflict a little. If it doesn't, it could cool things down a little. That one tiny question doesn't nail down the big question, but it does contribute a little insight. And if we ask many tiny but pertinent questions, we can close in on an answer for the big question. Will North Korea conduct another nuclear test? Will it rebuff diplomatic talks on its nuclear program? Will it fire artillery at South Korea? Will a North Korean ship fire on a South Korean ship? The answers are cumulative. The more yeses, the likelier the answer to the big question is, this is going to end badly. I call this Bayesian question clustering because of its family resemblance to the Bayesian updating discussed in Chapter 7. Another way to think of it is to imagine a painter using the technique called pointillism. It consists of dabbing tiny dots on the canvas, nothing more. Each dot alone adds little. But as the dots collect, patterns emerge. With enough dots, an artist can produce anything from a vivid portrait to a sweeping landscape. There were question clusters in the IARPA tournament, but they arose more as a consequence of events than a diagnostic strategy. In future research, I want to develop the concept and see how effectively we can answer unscorable big questions with clusters of little ones. But the Leon Weasel tears are still not likely to be mollified. For one thing, I called my research program the Good Judgment Project, which seems to imply that accurate forecasting and good judgment are one and the same. But that's not what I intended. Foresight is one element of good judgment, but there are others, including some that cannot be counted and run through a scientist's algorithms. Moral judgment, for one. Another critical dimension of good judgment is asking good questions. Indeed, a far-sighted forecast flagging disaster or opportunity can't happen until someone thinks to pose the question. What qualifies as a good question? It's one that gets us thinking about something worth thinking about. So one way to identify a good question is what I call the smack the forehead test. When you read the question after time has passed, you smack your forehead and say, "If only I had thought of that before." Here is one Tom Friedman posed in September 2002. As I think about President Bush's plans to take out Saddam Hussein and rebuild Iraq into a democracy, one question gnaws at me. Is Iraq the way it is today because Saddam Hussein is the way he is? Or is Saddam Hussein the way he is because Iraq is the way it is? I mean, is Iraq a totalitarian dictatorship under a cruel, iron-fisted man because the country is actually an Arab Yugoslavia? A highly tribalized, artificial state? Or has Iraq, by now, congealed into a real nation? And once the cruel fist of Saddam is replaced by a more enlightened leadership, Iraq's talented, educated people will slowly produce a federal democracy. Friedman's questioning drew attention to what we now know were key drivers of later events, including the savage sectarianism that has devastated Iraq since the U.S. invasion of 2003. So it passes the smack the forehead test. That's particularly remarkable because Friedman became a strong supporter of the invasion, in part because his expectations of how things would unfold were presumably quite different from what actually happened. While we may assume that a super forecaster would also be a super questioner, and vice versa, we don't actually know that. Indeed, my best scientific guess is that they often are not. The psychological recipe for the ideal super forecaster may prove to be quite different from that for the ideal super questioner, as superb question generation often seems to accompany a hedgehog-like incisiveness and confidence that one has a big idea grasp of the deep drivers of an event. That's quite a different mindset from the foxy eclecticism and sensitivity to uncertainty that characterizes superb forecasting. This suggests a different way to look at an analysis like Friedman's. Consider a column Friedman wrote in December 2014 about the ramifications of the plunging price of oil. The last time the world witnessed such a steep and sustained drop in oil prices, from 1986 to 1999, it had some profound consequences for oil-dependent states and those who depended on their largesse. Friedman wrote, "The Soviet Empire collapsed. Iran elected a reformist president. Iraq invaded Kuwait, and Yasser Arafat, having lost his Soviet backer and Arab bankers, recognized Israel, to name but a few. Friedman's conclusion? If today's fall off in oil prices is sustained, we'll also be in for a lot of surprises, particularly in the petrostates of Venezuela, Iran, and Russia. Here was a vague warning of unspecified surprises in unspecified timeframes. As a forecast, that's not terribly helpful. This sort of thing is why some people see Friedman as a particularly successful and slippery pundit who has mastered the art of appearing to go out on a limb without ever venturing out. But the same column can be read less as a forecast than an attempt to draw the attention of forecasters to something they should be thinking about. In other words, it is a question, not an answer. Whether super forecasters can outpredict Friedman is both unknown and, for present purposes, beside the point. Super forecasters and super questioners need to acknowledge each other's complementary strengths, not dwell on each other's alleged weaknesses. Friedman poses provocative questions that super forecasters should use to sharpen their foresight. Super forecasters generate well-calibrated answers that super questioners should use to fine-tune and occasionally overhaul their mental models of reality. The Tom versus Bill frame, with which we started the book, is our final false dichotomy. We need a Tom-Bill symbiosis. That's a tall order. But there's a much bigger collaboration I'd like to see. It would be the holy grail of my research program, using forecasting tournaments to depolarize unnecessarily polarized policy debates and make us collectively smarter. One last idea. In October 2014, Bloomberg reporters did me a big favor by contacting the signatories of the letter I wrote about in Chapter 3, the one sent to Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke in November 2010, which warned that Bernanke's planned asset purchases risk currency debasement and inflation. Bernanke ignored that warning and forged ahead. In the following years, the U.S. dollar did not weaken and inflation did not rise. Many critics said that proved the signatories were wrong. But as I discussed in Chapter 3, the actual wording of the letter was so vague it was impossible to say that definitively. Several months after I wrote that chapter, Bloomberg reporters asked the signatories how they felt about the letter in hindsight. Those who responded unanimously said they were right. They wouldn't change a word. Their reasons fell into two categories. One, the forecast only appeared to have failed because people were looking at the wrong measure. I think there's plenty of inflation, the financial commentator James Grant told Bloomberg. Not at the checkout counter, necessarily, but on Wall Street. Two, if you look carefully at the language of the letter, it clearly has not been proven wrong. Note the word risk, and note the absence of a date, Neil Ferguson told Bloomberg. There is, in fact, still a risk of currency debasement and inflation. That captures perfectly what's wrong with so many public debates today. Recall that the severe economic turmoil of 2008 and 2009 generated a fierce policy debate. Two camps coalesced, the Keynesians and the Austerians. The Keynesians called for heroic improvisation by central banks and aggressive deficit spending by governments. The Austerians called for austerity, government budget cuts, and warned that the Keynesian policies would ignite inflation and sink currencies. Ultimately, governments struck various compromises. In some countries, the Keynesians got more of what they wanted. In others, the Austerians did. Time passed. And then? What should have happened is a comparison of what people predicted and what actually happened. And to the extent that people were wrong, they would say so and adjust their thinking accordingly. That's only rational. As J.M. Keynes is reputed to have said but did not, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? As it turned out, not much, sir. People so rarely adjusted their thinking that when the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, an Austerian, announced publicly that events had shown that Keynesians were closer to the truth, it made headlines. That could have read, "Man changes his mind in response to evidence." The 2014 Bloomberg follow-up to the 2010 letter illustrates failure. I am not saying the letter writers were wrong on substance. I am agnostic on issues outside my field. The failure is one of process. In 2010, one group spelled out their beliefs in writing, and warned that if Bernanke pursued his policy, certain results would follow. Another group vehemently disagreed. 4 years passed, and no one budged. That should be unsatisfactory to everyone, no matter what their views on the merits. There were attempts to extract lessons from events during those years, but they mostly involved brute force. Hammering opponents both for their forecasting failures and for not acknowledging them was a standard theme in the columns of Paul Krugman, whose Nobel Prize in Economics and New York Times bully pulpit made him the most prominent Keynesian. Krugman's appointments hammered back. Neil Ferguson wrote a three-part catalog of Krugman's alleged failures. Back and forth it went, with each side poring over the other's forecasts, looking for failures, deflecting attacks, and leveling accusations. For fans of one side or the other, it may have been thrilling. For those who hope that we can become collectively wiser, it was a bewildering fracas that looked less like a debate between great minds and more like a food fight between rival fraternities. These are accomplished people debating pressing issues, but nobody seems to have learned anything beyond how to defend their original position. We can do better. Remember the adversarial collaboration between Daniel Kahneman and Gary Klein? These two psychologists won acclaim by developing apparently contradictory schools of thought, making each man a threat to the legacy of the other. But they were committed to playing by scientific ground rules, so they got together to discuss why they had such different views and how they could be reconciled. Something similar could, in principle, be done in forecasting. When a debate like Keynesians versus Austerians emerges, key figures could work together, with the help of trusted third parties, to identify what they disagree about and which forecasts would meaningfully test those disagreements. The key is precision. It's one thing for Austerians to say a policy will cause inflation and Keynesians to say it won't. But how much inflation? Measured by what benchmark? Over what time period? The result must be a forecast question that reduces ambiguity to an absolute minimum. A single dot on a canvas is not a painting, and a single bet cannot resolve a complex theoretical dispute. This will take many questions and question clusters. Of course, it's possible that if large numbers of questions are asked, each side may be right on some forecasts but wrong on others, and the final outcome won't generate the banner headlines that celebrity bets sometimes do. But as software engineers say, that's a feature, not a bug. A major point of view rarely has zero merit, and if a forecasting contest produces a split decision, we will have learned that the reality is more mixed than either side thought. If learning, not gloating, is the goal, that is progress. The catch is that the Kahneman-Klein collaboration presumed good faith. Each side wanted to be right, but they wanted the truth more. Sadly, in noisy public arenas, strident voices dominate debates, and they have zero interest in adversarial collaboration. But let's not make the cynic's mistake of thinking that those who dominate debates are the only debaters. We hear them most because they are the loudest, and the media reward people who shout into bullhorns. But there are less voluble and more reasonable voices. With their adversaries and a moderator, let them design clear tests of their beliefs. When the results run against their beliefs, some will try to rationalize away the facts, but they will pay a reputational price. Others will do the honorable thing and say, "I was wrong." But most important, we can all watch, see the results, and get a little wiser. All we have to do is get serious about keeping score. Epilogue. As I was finishing this manuscript, I shared the first chapter with Bill Flack, who confessed he is not quite a native Cornhusker, as I identified him. Bill was born in Kansas City, Missouri, and his family moved to Nebraska when he was 7. Whether he qualifies as a native depends on which dictionary one consults. Some might dismiss that as hair-splitting, but I see precision, one reason why Bill Flack is a super forecaster. Here's another. Bill doesn't think he should be invited to Davos. "I'd have to go to Google just to find out who the Prime Minister of Fanatistan is," he wrote. "The seats at Davos should be saved for people who can lecture without notes on Fanatistani politics and economics and demographics. and who know that the Prime Minister and the General-in-Chief have hated each other ever since the PM's brother-in-law made a noisy, drunken spectacle of himself at the General-in-Chief's daughter's wedding. Recognize that? It's intellectual humility. Bill knows what he doesn't know, and respects those who do. The Tom Friedman of the world possess that kind of in-depth knowledge, and that makes them valuable. Still, Bill Flack has an outstanding record of forecasting tough, real-world questions, and he has the Breyer score to prove it. The Tom Friedman of the world do not. Some people in Bill's position might get cocky, but not Bill. He doesn't dismiss pundits. He uses them. There are good pundits and bad pundits for my purposes, of course. The bad ones issue their predictions with no supporting arguments, expecting their readers to treat their pronouncements like the word from Mount Sinai. Or they back their forecasts with anecdotes rather than useful facts. The good ones argue the case for their forecasts. In fact, I see them as functioning something like lawyers in an adversarial judicial system. They put forth the best argument they can for why X is going to happen, and I consider everybody's arguments, dig further into background as necessary, and come up with my own forecast as a weighted sum of theirs. I share Bill's dragonfly-eye view of how he and Tom Friedman complement each other. And I would tack on a baseball metaphor to his courtroom metaphor. Big strategic thinkers like Friedman will probably never step to the plate and let us compare their batting averages with those of super forecasters like Bill. But they might be amenable to pitching forecasting questions at aspiring batters. Friedman pitched some great questions on Iraq in 2002, and some of his 2014 Petrostate questions may prove tricky to hit. Bill knows there is no guarantee he will continue to be a great batter. He also knows that his success hinges on more than the quality of the pitching. Slumps are inevitable because we frequently pass through phases of history riddled with irreducible uncertainty. Phases in which luck trumps skill. These are the moments when the laws of statistics tell us to shift bets and put our money on massive regression to the mean. How would he react when that happens? "That possibility is very much before my eyes," he wrote. "I know well that luck played a part in the success that I've had. That luck may turn. An overconfident forecast that goes bad can hit one hard in the Breyer score, and a few such could make the difference between a terrific season and a terrible one. It probably wouldn't shatter my image of myself as a reasonably competent super forecaster, but it'd probably make me more cautious and less prone to extreme forecasts. This would probably be a salutary thing, of course. The Breyer score gives me feedback on whether I'm under or overconfident, and I modify my forecasting behavior in response to it." I can't imagine a better description of the try, fail, analyze, adjust, try again cycle, and of the grit to keep at it and keep improving. Bill Flack is perpetual beta. And that, too, is why he is a super forecaster.
Appendix. 10 Commandments for Aspiring Super Forecasters. The guidelines sketched here distill key themes in this book and in training systems that have been experimentally demonstrated to boost accuracy in real-world forecasting contests. For more details, visit www.goodjudgment.com. 1. Triage. Focus on questions where your hard work is likely to pay off. Don't waste time either on easy, clock-like questions, where simple rules of thumb can get you close to the right answer, or on impenetrable, cloud-like questions, where even fancy statistical models can't beat the dart-throwing chimp. Concentrate on questions in the Goldilocks zone of difficulty, where effort pays off the most. For instance, who will win the presidential election 12 years out in 2028 is impossible to forecast now. Don't even try. Could you have predicted in 1940 the winner of the election, 12 years out in 1952? If you think you could have known it would be a then unknown colonel in the United States Army, Dwight Eisenhower, you may be afflicted by one of the worst cases of hindsight bias ever documented by psychologists. Of course, triage judgment calls get harder as we come closer to home. How much justifiable confidence can we place in March 2015
on who will win the 2016 election? The short answer is not a lot, but still a lot more than we can for the election in 2028. We can at least narrow the 2016 field to a small set of plausible contenders, which is a lot better than the vast set of unknown, Eisenhower-ish, possibilities lurking in 2028. Certain classes of outcomes have well-deserved reputations for being radically unpredictable. For example, oil prices, currency markets. But we usually don't discover how unpredictable outcomes are until we have spun our wheels for a while, trying to gain analytical traction. Bear in mind the two basic errors it is possible to make here. We could fail to try to predict the potentially predictable, or we could waste our time trying to predict the unpredictable. Which error would be worse in the situation you face? 2. Break seemingly intractable problems into tractable subproblems. Channel the playful but disciplined spirit of Enrico Fermi, who, when he wasn't designing the world's first atomic reactor, loved ballparking answers to head-scratchers such as, how many extraterrestrial civilizations exist in the universe? Decompose the problem into its knowable and unknowable parts. Flush ignorance into the open. Expose and examine your assumptions. Dare to be wrong by making your best guesses. Better to discover errors quickly than to hide them behind vague verbiage. Superforecasters see Fermiizing as part of the job. How else could they generate quantitative answers to seemingly impossible to quantify questions about Arafat's autopsy, bird flu epidemics, oil prices, Boko Haram, the Battle of Aleppo, and bond yield spreads? We find this Fermiizing spirit at work even in the quest for love, the ultimate unquantifiable. Consider Peter Backus, a lonely guy in London, who guesstimated the number of potential female partners in his vicinity by starting with the population of London, approximately 6 million, and winnowing that number down by the proportion of women in the population, about 50%, by the proportion of singles, about 50%, by the proportion in the right age range, about 20%, by the proportion of university graduates, about 26%, by the proportion he finds attractive, only 5%, by the proportion likely to find him attractive, only 5%, and by the proportion likely to be compatible with him, about 10%. Conclusion? Roughly 26 women in the pool, a daunting but not impossible search task. There are no objectively correct answers to true love questions, but we can score the accuracy of the Fermi estimates that super forecasters generate in the IARPA tournament. The surprise is how often remarkably good probability estimates arise from a remarkably crude series of assumptions and guesstimates. 3. Strike the right balance between inside and outside views. Superforecasters know that there is nothing new under the sun. Nothing is 100% unique. Linguists be damned, uniqueness is a matter of degree. So superforecasters conduct creative searches for comparison classes even for seemingly unique events, such as the outcome of a hunt for a high-profile terrorist, Joseph Kony, or the standoff between a new socialist government in Athens and Greece's creditors. Superforecasters are in the habit of posing the outside view question, how often do things of this sort happen in situations of this sort? So too, apparently, is Larry Summers, a Harvard professor and former Treasury Secretary. He knows about the planning fallacy. When bosses ask employees how long it will take to finish a project, employees tend to underestimate the time they need, often by factors of 2 or 3. Summers suspects his own employees are no different. One former employee, Greg Mankiw, himself now a famous economist, recalls Summers' strategy. He doubled the employee's estimate, then moved to the next higher time unit. So if the research assistant says the task will take an hour, it will take 2 days. If he says 2 days, it will take 4 weeks. It's a nerd joke. Summers corrected for employees' failure to take the outside view in making estimates by taking the outside view toward employees' estimates, and then inventing a funny correction factor. Of course, Summers would adjust his correction factor if an employee astonished him and delivered on time. He would balance his outside view expectation of tardiness against the new inside view evidence that a particular employee is an exception to the rule. Because each of us is, to some degree, unique. 4. Strike the right balance between under and overreacting to evidence. Belief updating is to good forecasting as brushing and flossing are to good dental hygiene. It can be boring, occasionally uncomfortable, but it pays off in the long term. That said, don't suppose that belief updating is always easy because it sometimes is. Skillful updating requires teasing subtle signals from noisy news flows, all the while resisting the lure of wishful thinking. Savvy forecasters learn to ferret out telltale clues before the rest of us. They snoop for non-obvious lead indicators about what would have to happen before X could, where X might be anything from an expansion of Arctic sea ice to a nuclear war in the Korean Peninsula. Note the fine line here between picking up subtle clues before everyone else and getting suckered by misleading clues. Does the appearance of an article critical of North Korea in the official Chinese press signal that China is about to squeeze Pyongyang hard? Or was it just a quirky error in editorial judgment? The best forecasters tend to be incremental belief updaters, often moving from probabilities of, say, 0.4 to 0.35, or from 0.6 to 0.65, distinctions too subtle to capture with vague verbiage like might or maybe, but distinctions that, in the long run, define the difference between good and great forecasters. Yet super forecasters also know how to jump, to move their probability estimates fast in response to diagnostic signals. Super forecasters are not perfect Bayesian updaters, but they are better than most of us. And that is largely because they value this skill and work hard at cultivating it. 5. Look for the clashing causal forces at work in each problem. For every good policy argument, there is typically a counterargument that is at least worth acknowledging. For instance, if you are a devout dove who believes that threatening military action never brings peace, be open to the possibility that you might be wrong about Iran. And the same advice applies if you are a devout hawk who believes that soft appeasement policies never pay off. Each side should list, in advance, the signs that would nudge them toward the other. Now here comes the really hard part. In classical dialectics, thesis meets antithesis, producing synthesis. In Dragonfly Eye, one view meets another and another and another, all of which must be synthesized into a single image. There are no paint-by-number rules here. Synthesis is an art that requires reconciling irreducibly subjective judgments. If you do it well, engaging in this process of synthesizing should transform you from a cookie-cutter dove or hawk into an odd hybrid creature, a dove-hawk, with a nuanced view of when tougher or softer policies are likelier to work. 6. Strive to distinguish as many degrees of doubt as the problem permits, but no more. Few things are either certain or impossible, and maybe isn't all that informative. So your uncertainty dial needs more than three settings. Nuance matters. The more degrees of uncertainty you can distinguish, the better a forecaster you are likely to be. As in poker, you have an advantage if you are better than your competitors at separating 60-40 bets from 40-60, or 55-45 from 45-55. Translating vague verbiage hunches into numeric probabilities feels unnatural at first, but it can be done. It just requires patience and practice. The super forecasters have shown what is possible. Most of us could learn, quite quickly, to think in more granular ways about uncertainty. Recall the episode in which President Obama was trying to figure out whether Osama bin Laden was the mystery occupant of the walled-in compound in Abbottabad, and recall the probability estimates of his intelligence officers and the president's reaction to their estimates. This is 50-50, a flip of the coin. Now suppose that President Obama had been shooting the breeze with basketball buddies and each one offered probability estimates on the outcome of a college game, and those estimates corresponded exactly to those offered by intelligence officers on the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden. Would the president still have shrugged and said, "This is 50-50? Or would he have said, "Sounds like the odds fall between 3-1 and 4-1. I bet on the latter. The president is accustomed to granular thinking in the domain of sports. Every year he enjoys trying to predict the winners of the March Madness basketball tournament, a probability puzzle that draws the attention of serious statisticians. But, like his Democratic and Republican predecessors, he does not apply the same rigor to national security decisions. Why? Because different norms govern different thought processes. Reducing complex hunches to scorable probabilities is de rigueur in sports, but not in national security. So, don't reserve rigorous reasoning for trivial pursuits. George Tenet would not have dared utter slam dunk about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq if the Bush 43 White House had enforced standards of evidence and proof that are second nature to seasoned gamblers on sporting events. Slam dunk implies one is willing to offer infinite odds, and to lose everything if one is wrong. 7. Strike the right balance between under and overconfidence, between prudence and decisiveness. Superforecasters understand the risks, both in rushing to judgment and of dawdling too long near maybe. They routinely manage the trade-off between the need to take decisive stands, who wants to listen to a waffler, and the need to qualify their stands, who wants to listen to a blowhard. They realize that long-term accuracy requires getting good scores on both calibration and resolution, which requires moving beyond blame game ping pong. It is not enough just to avoid the most recent mistake. They have to find creative ways to tamp down both types of forecasting errors, misses and false alarms, to the degree a fickle world permits such uncontroversial improvements in accuracy. 8. Look for the errors behind your mistakes, but beware of rear-view mirror hindsight biases. Don't try to justify or excuse your failures. Own them. Conduct unflinching postmortems. Where exactly did I go wrong? And remember that although the more common error is to learn too little from failure and to overlook flaws in your basic assumptions, it is also possible to learn too much. You may have been basically on the right track, but made a minor technical mistake that had big ramifications. Also, don't forget to do postmortems on your successes, too. Not all successes imply that your reasoning was right. You may have just lucked out by making offsetting errors. And if you keep confidently reasoning along the same lines, you are setting yourself up for a nasty surprise. 9. Bring out the best in others, and let others bring out the best in you. Master the fine arts of team management, especially perspective taking, understanding the arguments of the other side so well that you can reproduce them to the other's satisfaction, precision questioning, helping others to clarify their arguments so that they are not misunderstood, and constructive confrontation, learning to disagree without being disagreeable. Wise leaders know how fine the line can be between a helpful suggestion and micromanagerial meddling, or between a rigid group and a decisive one, or between a scatterbrained group and an open-minded one. Tommy Lasorda, the former coach of the Los Angeles Dodgers, got it roughly right. Managing is like holding a dove in your hand. If you hold it too tightly, you kill it. But if you hold it too loosely, you lose it. 10. Master the error-balancing bicycle. Implementing each commandment requires balancing opposing errors. Just as you can't learn to ride a bicycle by reading a physics textbook, you can't become a super forecaster by reading training manuals. Learning requires doing, with good feedback that leaves no ambiguity about whether you are succeeding, I'm rolling along smoothly, or whether you are failing, crash. Also remember that practice is not just going through the motions of making forecasts, or casually reading the news and tossing out probabilities. Like all other known forms of expertise, super forecasting is the product of deep, deliberative practice. 11. Don't treat commandments as commandments. It is impossible to lay down binding rules, Helmut von Moltke warned, because two cases will never be exactly the same. As in war, so in all things. Guidelines are the best we can do in a world where nothing is certain or exactly repeatable. Super forecasting requires constant mindfulness, even when, perhaps especially when, you are dutifully trying to follow these commandments.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction, written by Dan Gardner and Philip Tetlock, performed by Joel Richards, producer Mike Charzik, copyright 2015 by Philip Tetlock Consulting, Inc., and Connaught Street, Inc. Production copyright 2015 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.